настроение с добрым утром.
That was "They're Coming to Take Me Away". Coming up, "They're Coming to Take Me Away". But first, it's the Dean Show, featuring everyone's favorite, the Dean. The Dean and his favorite mancer, Thaddeus Penguin.
Good evening, children of the Dean, and bienvenido al the Dean Show, episode 42. Thaddeus is here with me, as always, but he's still trying to get his headset sorted out, so he'll say hi in just a few moments. But I want to welcome you to episode 40 and tell you that I don't care whether or not you like it. Now, I've got lots of things up for you this week, including all the usual segments, the journal hopefully returning to its past glory this week, the return of the classic style journal, as well as additional anecdotes. Possibly I might throw in a little history lecture from Reese, but I'll put it at the end so that you can turn off before that bit, because it's a bit boring. And all sorts of great stuff. Reese is, of course, let's talk about Reese. Recently, I mean, I am obviously a huge celebrity, but oh wait, Thaddeus is, okay, he's sort of signaling that he's ready to go, so let's hear from Thaddeus. Well, it's good to see your mic's working, and you know what, I think you might be right. This is, in fact, not episode 42, but 41. Now then, as I was saying, Thaddeus wasn't fortunate enough to meet this guy, but as I said, I am the Dean, obviously. I am superior to all of you, inferior scum. You know, I make the show for myself, not you, and all of that. But I'm pretty famous, you know, around these parts. I'd say I'm certainly should be some sort of world dictator or something, and I'm completely awesome and live in the Temple of the Dean. A little bit of backstory for new listeners there. But despite that, I don't often meet other celebrities because I generally don't care. But I was fortunate enough recently to meet Reese. The Reese, that's right. Gasp, all you listeners, I met the Reese. That would be the history teacher slash historian dude who in fact wrote the textbook on the Irish question that the A-level classes currently use. So there you go, Reese. I was given a lecture by him, and as I said, I recorded the first third of that, first 42-minute session, on the Home Rule issue, and I might tack it on to the end of the show, if you wish to hear it, and if you don't. But, and I was fortunate enough to meet this guy, Reese, so, I mean, this is the sort of thing that you would, you know, note down in your diary, remember to tell your grandchildren, you know, this is the day you met Reese. Put this in your, on your calendar. You know, get an autograph from Reese. Put this in your Facebook status, you know, met Reese today. Get your photograph taken, group photograph taken with Reese. Of course, I'm the Dean and I'm so awesome I didn't do any of that because I'm probably a bigger celebrity than him. But even so, it was still cool to meet the Reese. The cult of Reese, let it live on. So there, that's that. That's my news on meeting Reese. And up next, we're going to have the quiz, and that'll introduce you to this week's sponsor. No, what's that? Come on, Thaddeus. Not everyone can meet Reese. It's not much point in meeting a celebrity if everyone can do it, even manservants. Menservant, should that be? Who knows? We've had this before. So, the quiz. New question. I don't know where. No one is entering this quiz for some reason, despite the fact that 10-year vamp are awesome. Whatever happened to Hugh Sullivan? Isn't he going to enter our quiz like he usually does? Win this 10-year vamp CD promotion pack full of photos and things and a sticker and info and live photos and things and CD plus bonus package with Scientology and all sorts of craziness in your bonus package. You can win this. The new question, very simple question. You ready? All you've got to do to be in with a chance of winning this is send us an email, okay? and tell us which of these songs, nothing to do with Tenure Vamp this time, this week, just tell us which of these songs you like most. Okay? Is it A, Whole Lotta Rosie? B, Whole Lotta Love? Or C, Whole Lotta Shaking Going On? Just tell us which one you prefer. Now, I put them in, let's see, I'd say Rosie, Shaken, and Love in that order, but that's just the order of I like the bands who did them. So, but there's no right answer here. Just give us your opinion, and anyone who does will be in with a chance of winning this pack. Now, to move on, that was the quiz. Now I'm going to introduce you to our brand new permanent sponsor, hopefully. We don't seem to be able to keep these sponsors for too long, but hopefully this will be a new one. Brand new sponsor for this week. Here we go. Hit it, Thaddeus. In fact, before we get to your sponsor proper with the paid for sponsorship ad, I should put in a special mention. Also, you know, special mention goes to the Cult of Reese, because if you're in difficulty, or you've gotten yourself into a bit of a sticky wicket, just ask yourself, what would Reese do? And now here's our sponsor. Okay, while Thaddeus finds the file, I'm just going to continue. Right, so I'm just going to move on. We're going to have a little bit of a continuation with the show. I want to talk about this thing. I was buying some presents for the Christmas. I do that. I'm actually a nice person also. I said do-do. I was buying some presents for the Xmas on the Amazon. And I noticed a little thing. Recommended for you. And Amazon recommended to me the A Dangerous Man. Pre-order released December 28th. The brand new movie starring Steven Seagal. So of course I just had to pre-order A Dangerous Man, originally called On the Run, renamed. Most of his movies go through like 10 named. This is going to be a good one, I think. It's going to be a good one. Now, on that Seagal note, we're going to introduce the Nile of the Week with this, because I had, I lent The Keeper to Nile. See, I lent Nico Above the Law to Alex. You may remember some of these people from behind the curtain. I lent this to Alex, and he said it was great, just like when I lent him Fire Down Below, said it was great. I lent The Keeper, which is absolutely awesome, you know, it's up there with Under Siege almost, lend it to Niall, our resident fool at the other end. And Niall said, I watched that DVD you lent me, The Dean, and I was, oh, and it was awesome, wasn't it? And he said, really, really bad. What? See, Niall, he complained because the final boss fight was easy. Seagal just beats everyone up. I was like, that's the whole point. You're missing the point, Niall. Seagal has such a huge ego that he can't possibly have to put in effort to his fights. He should easily be able to beat everyone up in an instant. That's the whole point. And in other reasons, so the Nile of the Week is going to Nile this week. You know, occasionally, the segment was named after him. Occasionally, he does win it. The proof, people wonder, why do we have this Nile of the Week? I mean, has Nile done anything so ridiculously silly? Well, yes, this here, this bit up next is evidence. This is why we have the Nile of the Week, okay? This is why Nile is the fool. Last year, in the school studies AS level, Niall studied the ICT. He did not continue those studies into A2 level, thus he dropped the ICT. However, he is still entered into the ICT A2 exam. So he's doing an exam for a subject he dropped without having done any coursework or, you know, learned anything all year. He's not meant to be doing the exam, but he was entered by mistake. But he's too incompetent to get his name taken off the list, which means that he may actually have to do the exam, because he should have gotten his name stroked from the list about a month ago. Furthermore, he's supposed to have signed up for a careers interview several weeks ago to sort out his university places, and he hasn't actually... I think he may have done that, you know, about 3 weeks late. Yesterday he may have finally got to that. You know, so this is incompetence. You know, another example was, of course, when we went to see the Men Who Stare at Goats, and Niall forgot to turn up. You know, this is the sort of thing that... This is why we have the Niall of the Week. So, I'm going to play the Niall of the Week music, and, well, actually, I've sort of explained the Niall of the Week already, so I just play the music, because that's what I do. Now, I'll play that. Thaddeus seems to be still... What did you do? When these people record their sponsorship ads, Thaddeus, what on earth do you put the file? It's ridiculous. You're going to have a folder, ad, and then done. What on earth are you doing? You try to get that darn file for the sponsor sorted out. Get that while I play the music for the Niall of the Week. Niall of the Week. Niall of the Week. Niall. 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 Niall of the Week. Fool at the other end. Niall of the Week. Fool at the other end. Okay, so as I've mentioned, the Niall of the Week this week is... Niall! Furthermore, another reason why he's Niall of the Week is that, remember I said I was hoping to do a monthly show with him? It was going to be on religion and atheism. Once a month, yeah, not going to happen. Too incompetent for that. Yeah, another reason, actually, we went to see Bill Bailey. Did I mention this? I didn't mention this. This needs to be mentioned. Why isn't this mentioned? It's up next. We went to see Bill Bailey. Niall was arrived like a minute before the show started. We all had to, meant to wait for him in the foyer, but we had to take our seats because he was so ridiculously tardy. Now then, that's a good segue. So we're going to hold off the sponsor and we're going to talk about Bill Bailey first. Last Sunday there, just after the show had been released, last week's show, that's why I wasn't on it, I went to see Bill Bailey. I may have mentioned this somewhere in the journal, I don't know, but I went to see Bill Bailey along with, you know, Evan and... Jack and Damien and Alex and Bryners and of course the Niall, and what happened there was, you know, we arrived, we went, took our seats at the Waterfront Hall, very very nice venue, and you know, Bill Bailey, remarkable guide to the orchestra, so we had an orchestra with him and it was like a musical comedy. He did jokes, they did classical music, they meshed together, it worked. He was way over with the crowd, as you might expect, since they paid to see him, 35 quid. And, I mean, he started off making fun of Chris de Burgh, who I don't actually know who that is, but it was funny anyway. It was absolutely hilarious. Then he made fun of... He did lots of funny jokes with, you know, playing funny music and stuff, and of course they made fun of the, sort of, Cockney music. Something like Have a Banana. And then there's that little tune, it's like, dun 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 dun, oi! And they mix that into classical music, you know, with a little Cockney twist in it. Very good. After the show, he ran back out to tell us that the Jedward had been eliminated from X Factor, which was full of lulls. Also, the best part, I think, was they got a huge table with bells, these crazy little bells, and there was about five of them, some guys in the orchestra helping out, and they played a crazy little tune on these bells, like ringing up and down, running up and down the table with these bells, absolutely amazing. And then in the middle they slipped in the little Cockney bit. It was a great show, absolutely fantastic. I highly recommend this Bill Bailey. And of course they did the Human Slaves and an Insect Nation song, and I'm pretty sure there was one other really funny thing that happened that I'm forgetting, but they made fun of, like, 70s cop shows and stuff, and, The Leg of Time, that song. I should have recorded something from this show. Absolutely amazing. I really, really recommend this Bill Bailey. And of course, next month, we're going to see Eddie Izzard. I remember hoping to go to the Continental Fair just before that starts. So that should be great. And, that's that. That is, of course, if Niall's competent enough to arrange going to the fair. Now then, Thaddeus, for goodness sake, have you got the sponsor file? This is beginning to get ridiculous. I'm going to have to fill. I'm going to have to be a bandicoot. You're like a bandicoot. You're like on an island. Ripperoo and the like. Something about a pinstripe potteroo with a Tommy gun. Jumping on boxes. Papu Papu with a stick. Koala Kong throwing rocks at you. Brio turning into the Hulk of some sort. Cortex existing. The female bandicoot. Tana. Just ringing any bells with anyone. Like a bandicoot, you're like on an island. Anyone have a clue what's going on here? And now the screensaver. I mean, for goodness sake, Thaddeus, what do I not pay you for? I mean, here I am, not paying you with my non-paying you money that I didn't earn, that I just have because I'm awesome and rich, that I'm actually not giving you. Here I am, putting, you know, and what am I not paying you for exactly? Because you're not even finding the sponsor ad. You're stopping the screensaver from coming on here on the laptop of awesome. Sometimes I think that you're a bit overrated, Thaddeus. Having a manservant is a bit overrated. You know? Like, it's a bit like, well, Reese, for a start, he was a bit overrated. People in general are a bit overrated, to be honest. We don't really need those people. And one thing that's really overrated are listeners. We don't need them at all on this show. No place for listeners. Only the Dean is relevant. Well, in that case, play the darn thing, Thaddeus. Oh, before you do, I just remembered, I told everyone to enter the quiz, and I didn't tell you how. Leave a comment on thedeanshow.blogspot.com or email thaddeuspenguin@hotmail.com, and that applies to any feedback for the show in any way. Here's the sponsor.
This week, The Dean Show is sponsored by Wind Repellent. Climbing a ladder? Falling from a tree? Get rid of that pesky wind today with Wind Repellent. Advantages: safely and securely repels blood from your body with little to no side effects. Disadvantage: may not be real. Order today to receive your free complimentary repellent stick at no extra cost. Postage and packaging costs 100 quadrillion pounds.
And that, of course, was a message from our brand new sponsor, Wind Repellent, where there is a fire at one end and a fool, Niall, at the other. Okay, so up next, I'm going to talk a little bit about things and stuff. Games, what I've been playing, Modern Warfare 2. Some of this stuff's probably in the journal, I don't even remember. But I got Modern Warfare 2. I haven't played it online yet, but I've been playing a bit of offline single player for a couple hours one day. I am really liking it. It is pretty darn good. And I hope to get online and a good battle will be had. It is a good game. It's a war game. You know, I'm not usually into that sort of thing, but I was convinced to buy this and I am enjoying it. I haven't been playing anything else. Films, let's see. Some stuff that I mentioned in the journal that I won't go into now, because the journal's up next anyway. Apart from that, I don't think I've really seen any other films. Music is interesting. I have my Chuck Berry cassette tape. I don't know if I mentioned this, but good songs in this, like Anthony Boy, my new favourite song. I'm going to play a clip from that right now. And 30 Days, another good one. And Jaguar and Thunderbird. Some really good Chuck Berry songs I didn't know about before. So I'm going to have a clip from Anthony Boy, and then I'm going to talk a little bit about Chuck Berry before the journal.
In the morning, and I'm moving on out to school with an open book and a sleepy look. The teacher can't be fooled. I catch up fast in the early class. The teacher will never know that I postponed my work at home watching the evening show. Hey there, Anthony Boy, why you in such a rush? Oh! The girl, she wanna talk to you. Look at him, he's a bush. Oh! 3 o'clock in the afternoon completes the day of school. Before the ding can cease to ring, he's in the
How absolutely epic and upbeat was that? I love it. Anthony Boy, absolutely fantastic song. So upbeat, I love the chorus. Hey there, Anthony Boy, why in such a rush? Whoa! Love it. And then later it goes on, Susie and Yackard and some people, I don't know. were yakety-yakking with Joan about some things that Anthony told her over the telephone. And Susie told me the secret that I had told her not to tell. But now that I know you know, she knows you know that all is well. Whoa, hey there, Anthony boy, why in such a rush? Whoa, it's just absolutely epic. Less than 2 minutes long, but a fantastic song. Now then, with that said, I'm going to talk a little bit about Chuck Berry. The guy is awesome, first of all. And I think it should also be known that he was supposed to have a UK tour in this year. Recently, the first night was supposed to be on the 21st of November in Newcastle, I believe, in England. Now, it didn't happen. Now, I looked on his website. The tour was posted at the start of January, and there were two possible tours originally. Obviously, they settled on one, and they were all reschedulings, which means that they were rescheduled from 2008, presumably. Now they've been rescheduled again to March 2010, so you've actually, if you buy tickets to see Chuck Berry, don't expect to see him within the next 2 years. Unless it's at that Blueberry Hill place he plays in every month. But, apart, you know, up in, St. Louis, is it? No, that's where Jerry Lee Lewis comes from. Yeah, I don't know, maybe both of them are from there, who knows, doesn't matter. Maybe I'm wrong, who cares? The point is, no one knew the show was cancelled. Except Chuck Berry, he just decided it is cancelled. So the band who were supposed to support him turned up for the show. People who paid for their valid tickets turned up at the venue. People got who'd paid to go see, because it's pretty special to see Chuck Berry, you know. People had bought plane flights and booked hotels for the weekend and driven for millions of, well, you know, long distances. And got to the arena and the guy's like, yeah, come back in March. No one knew it was cancelled. Apparently, the promoter had said to Chuck Berry, we'll pay you at the end of the 20 days after the tour finishes, and he just said, no, cancelled, done, not doing it. I don't do business like that. You pay me now. I mean, you wouldn't think he'd still need money after all this time. I mean, he debuted with Maybelline in 55, you know, and he said quite a few hits, like, I don't know, I understand why he needs the money. That's not the point. The point is, you know, you don't tell a man you're not going to pay him. So basically just, he said the tour is cancelled, done, didn't tell anyone, just over. I quite like that about the man, but it's also rather interesting that, you know, no one was told about this, he just didn't, people turn up for the show to find that Chuck had just not gone to it. I love that. And some other things about Chuck I may have mentioned before, like, apparently he doesn't tell his band what songs they're going to be playing. He just, you know, he plays the guitar intro, which most of them sound the same. And they just got to work out which song it is. And Alex McIntyre, he'd been telling me that he heard somewhere that Chuck, if he's booked to play for an hour, he, you know, as soon as the hour's up, he'll stop mid-song and walk out. You know, that's the sort of thing he does. But, I mean, the guy is awesome. And I figured this out. Modern music all came from rock and roll. I've said this bit before, okay? The first half of this has been said before. All modern music came from rock and roll. Obviously, it evolved into rock. And metal and so on. Obviously, the beat from it evolved into dance, not in clubs. So all of this modern music came from rock and roll. Chuck Berry defined rock and roll. You know, he made rock and roll what it is. He defined what it was about and how it would be made and the music for it. Chuck Berry is the father of rock and roll. Thus, Chuck Berry is the father of all modern music. Thus, he is the single biggest influence in musical history. Thus, every song made from the 70s onwards, they should have to pay royalties to Chuck Berry for being awesome and influencing their music. That's just my opinion. He should have patented modern music. Now then, yeah, so just a little bit about Chuck Berry there. So, that's that bit done. I think up next we're going to have, I want to say the journal, but I think before we get to the journal we're going to have a couple of other bits and pieces. We're going to have the meme and the F My Life. I'll squeeze those in now. Meme of the week. Meme of the week, meme of the week, meme of the week. silly internet meme thing, funny thing, internet phenomenon of the week. Meme of the week. Okay, this week it's an old popular internet sort of slash nerd phrase slash saying slash gimmick thing. The old accidentally, you know, you say, I accidentally X. I accidentally the whole thing. Okay, it is now tomorrow, but nonetheless, sticking with the meme segment, no time has passed for you. I believe I found an online use of this particular meme in something that appears to be rather amusing, so I'm gonna read out a dialogue option. It was from some sort of instant messaging conversaciones. Okay, let's beginning from the start. You are connected to another user. I just accidentally a Coca-Cola bottle. Is this bad? Accidentally what? A Coca-Cola bottle. What happened with the bottle? I can't understand the way you're phrasing your question. Oh, I was just messing around and I accidentally the whole bottle. I think you're missing a word because I still can't figure out what you did. Did you drink all of the soda? Is the bottle broken? Think. Is the bottle stuck somewhere? Hold on one sec. I need to the bottle. To what, the bottle? Yeah, I like the whole bottle, lol. I'm sorry, I'm hoping that it's a language barrier or something that's making me not be able to understand you, because all you've told me is that something happened with the whole bottle, but you haven't told me what that is exactly. So unless you find some other way of telling me, I can't help you, sorry. Oh, sorry, it's just hard that I'm trying to type with you, and I'm having a hard time when the whole bottle accidentally, lol. Is your hand stuck in the bottle? Or is something else stuck in the bottle? Well, yeah, you know, when you and then the whole bottle get stuck. When you what? The word isn't showing up on the chat screen. Oh, really, isn't showing? You can't see? No, I can't. It's very frustrating. Weird. Well, you know. Have you ever with a whole bottle? That is, this is the whole thing. Maybe you need to see a doctor? I can't see the word, but I'm beginning to guess. Not sure a doctor can help me. I mean, it was accidentally the whole bottle. I'm sorry that I still can't figure out what happened exactly. People go to the emergency room for all sorts of things. You should ask someone else, because I don't think I can help you. Well, maybe I can explain it better when I tell you about where I live. Okay. You see, I was messing around in the playground with the poles in it, and then a couple of guys came around with these Coca-Cola bottles. Uh-huh. They were really up to no good. Then we were, and suddenly, I accidentally the whole bottle. Your sentences are missing words. Either you're not typing them, or the chat thing is taking them out. Possibly for profanity reasons. And my mum got scared and said, you're accidentally the whole bottle with your auntie and uncle in Bel Air. The other user has left the discussion. I whistled for a Coca-Cola truck, and when I came near the bottle said fresh and had ice in the rear. That's from Everything She Knows, she.org. Absolutely hilarious. I love it so much. What do you think about that, Thaddeus? Well, indeed, dear boy. Okay, so up next, it's the FML. FMyLife.com. Some stuff from FMyLife, cause it's funny, lol. People suck. Okay, I'm on the FMyLife.com. Got a couple here. One, I'm gonna have a look at which one's the best. Okay, I think I'm gonna go for this one. The most recent one. Today, after burning all my past papers, books, and notes in celebration of finishing maths forever, type of thing that I've done, I find out I have to retake my maths exam to get the minimum grade for college. F my life. There's another one. Today, a mall cop tore up my free hugs sign, FML. That's just mean. That is just mean. And finally, today I found out that my wife had an affair with our marriage counsellor. Fumble. And that's that. Now that's that segment over. Oh, F My Life the book? And you thought you'd had a bad day? Apparently this exists on Amazon already. Awesomes. You know what? I'm gonna Google there right now. Let's have a look. Buy it on Amazon UK. F My Life the book. Inspired by the hit website www.fmylife.com. Sometimes you do .occam, but then it doesn't load up terribly well. Amazon's loading, and we're gonna see about this book here. Maybe someone can have this as a Christmas present. After this, I've got some Steven Seagal stuff to talk about that I think you're gonna like. Unless, of course, I already did it on the show, which I might have done, so you might have the same segment twice, because I forget what I've already done on the show. But, you know what? I don't care. You get it twice. Yeah, so there's only 548, and you can get it used for 533 on Amazon UK. That's pretty cool. Of course, you'd probably rather pay the extra 15p to get a new copy. Okay, my idea is thus. I don't know if you know the British... I think I have done this, but I'm going to say it again, because I can't remember. The British reality show, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, it's in the jungle. Now what they do is they put celebrities in the jungle, and they do have I done this? This is like deja vu right here. They do tasks, and like eat disgusting things, and you get bugs and cockroaches and stuff, and then spiders on them, and all those sorts of creepy things, and argue with each other, and stuff like this. Okay, and they all wear a T-shirt, and it has their name and the phone number to call to vote for them. Now, you ready for this? Bam! Steven Seagal in the jungle. Of course, if I have done this already, you would be ready for it. If I haven't, then it's a surprise. Yay! Steven Seagal in the jungle. And of course, somehow, he's going to be wearing his Chinese suit. You just know it. And he's going to be, you know, just standing there with his that expression, you know, the slightly tilted head, the hands clasped in front of him, and the way he always does, and that soft voice. So, you know, tell people why they should vote for you. He's like, well, I'm Steven Seagal, and, you know, I got the best movies in the world, and I think you should vote for me. Because I'm Steven Seagal, and I'm a great actor, and I'm also a great musician. I'm the Mojo Priest. I got stunt doubles. So this is my other idea. My idea, stunt doubles. You ready for this? Seagal has, it's like a comedy skit almost, because he has, I don't know how you would work voice actors into it, but stunt doubles, you ready for this? Every time he's going to do a stunt, he has a trial. He has a stunt double, and it's the stunt. You can see the stunt double in the jungle at other times, so it's amusing, because it's like, oh, look, it's Seagal's stunt double. You know, they go to a trial, and Seagal gets nominated, and then his stunt double does it, and it's painfully obvious, but he pretends it's him, and they play it for the truth. I think this would be absolutely hilarious. I would love this so much. They don't even look anything like him. No, that would be an awesome idea, Thaddeus. You'd love it. Okay, up next, it's the Dinchonary. So this week on the Dinchonary, the word is Reese, the famous celebrity historian. Not okay. That's that. Now then. I don't believe I've done... It's been a couple days since I started recording this episode, so I don't think I've done the smiting list, so we're going to have that now, and I've forgotten who I was going to smite, but that's entirely besides the point.
And now, we present... The Dean and the Thaddeus present to you... The Smiting List. Prepare... To be... Smitten.
pretty loud there. That one always gets me pumped up. So who are we going to smite this week? I'm going to have to think about it because I actually don't know. It's the return of the evil werewolf we smote way back in near the beginning of the show's run. Remember, we were invaded twice, once by a werewolf, and then once in the igloo we were invaded by a clown or something. Now we've been invaded by the werewolf again. Or it could be a different one, since I smote the other one. But let's smite this one. So, rather than running and hiding like last time, we are prepared, Thaddeus. We can do it together. So, I'm a-charging my smitometer, and I'm a-firing my smiting. Lasers! Whoa, what on earth? Lasers sounding a little bit weird this week. It might need to be have some adjustments made to that. Anyway, nevertheless, he has been, whatever, what was I talking about again? Doesn't matter. Stuff has been smitten. The wolf thing. Go. Okay. Now we've got the journal still to come. And then, things and, all that stuff. So, well, that's actually it. So, the journal is pretty long, I think, but, here goes. The Dean's Journal, what's the Dean been up to? The Dean's Journal, Journal of the Dean. What's he been doing throughout the week? You get to hear what the Dean has been doing live, just as it actually happens. The Dean's Journal.
I have the recorder back. My precious. The recorder. Back from the evil Logiconner. We will never be parted again, except on weekends when I get custody on weekdays of the recorder. It is back, and for that we have had to make the necessary sacrifice of allowing Logiconner back into our podcasting circles. But that isn't important, because I have back the recorder for the journal. Okay, so I just watched the film Dracula, Dead and Loving It. Having just finished watching Mel Brooks' Blazing Saddles, one of my favourite movies of all time, I spotted another Mel Brooks film on. I've seen it before, a long time ago. Dracula, Dead and Loving It. It's a horror spoof. Thaddeus enjoyed it, I can tell. He's making the tea right now, so he's not here, but I'm pretty sure he enjoyed it. Hilarious movie. There are a couple of lol moments, and then, you know, it's one of, in general, it's one of those things that's sort of mildly amusing, but you don't literally laugh, but then there are a few moments where you will lol quite a lot. Mel Brooks, I mean, I know, of the two Mel Brooks movies, I know they're both awesome, so what can you say? But, I mean, this is really good. It's basically, it's a spoof on the Dracula story. Most people know that story, so there's not much point in me going into it in depth, but the guy wears like a ridiculous wig, and they try to discover that he's the vampire. There's a funny part where he's trying to mind control the girl, and she's in her room, and he's trying to come to the terrace door, and he's like, Nina, get up from your bed. Open the door. Walk through the door. And then she goes through the wrong door, and Nina, you are... No, Mina, sorry, I think it is. Mina. You are in the closet. Come back out. Now open the terrace door. And then the maid who he'd sent to sleep comes to the door, and they're both going, and he's like, you sit down, you stand up. No, 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 you stand, you sit down. And then in the end, he's like, never mind, I will come myself. And there's another funny moment when Renfield, his sort of servant dude, is in the sanitarium. He's meeting with Dr. Seward, and... he eats a bug off the table and tries to pretend it was a raisin, and then he eats a spider, and then afterwards he picks up a grasshopper and he eats it, and its leg is like hang out of his mouth, and the doctor is, you know, oh, this is most preposterous, you know. And then he's you just ate an insect. No, I didn't. He's like, yes, it's trying to escape from your mouth. I can see its legs sticking out of your mouth, the poor thing. He's like, no, it didn't. And, you know, for about a film, you know, they go on for a minute or two with the, he's trying to pretend it's not there when you can clearly see it sticking out of his mouth. It's quite funny. And then he just eats it. But everyone's, you know, well, I think the funniest part was when Mina had been, had her blood sucked for the first time, and then she'd sort of gone crazy, you know, the wild, sexy vampirus, and with her fiancé, and she said, because it's all very polite England, you know, so with her fiancé, and she said to him, you know, she was now feeling a bit sexy, if you know what I mean, horny, you know, and she said, you know, Jonathan, come sit with me. And he, you know, she sits on the bed, and he sits the chair at bottom of the bed. And she says, no, come closer. And he sits on the bed, and she says, touch this. And she tries to get him to touch her breast. And he's like, oh, no, I can't do such a thing. And she's like, no, you're right. I'll touch you. Oh, preposterous. And he tries to leave, and then she gets on his knees for some reason, I'm pretty sure. And she says, now touch this. And he's holding her, and then her dad comes in. He's like, oh, Jonathan, how could you? I bring you into my house, you eat my food, you drink my wine, and now, after being engaged to my daughter for only 5 years, you try to touch her? Get out of my house! Absolutely hilarious. So that's that. I read a review for it on the internets once, and it said it was horrible, but they were wrong. Okay, just ordered something on the Amazon. It is the Best of Chuck Berry cassette tape. That's right, this is how hardcore we are right here in the temple. Cassette tapes for the win.
Social conventions, and they don't sort of follow the normal, the social norms or whatever. Good, okay, so we saw...
It's pictorial, apparently, for the deputista. Pujol es otro pintor que imita Picasso. Y el más impresionante del grupo es...
That's an IT at the start.
Iturriaga. Escritor que no puede encontrar editor para su novela. Andrea compara la pintura de Huichol con la de Juan y señala que los cuadros de Huichol son mejores.
Okay, so...
I don't know if you can hear it, pick it up on this, but guess what? My Chuck Berry Best of 40 song cassette tape has arrived. Double cassette tape. So four sides then. 10 songs per side. I am loving it. That sort of grainy, old, bad quality tape recording effect, you know, makes it sound even more authentic 50s and 60s rock and roll. And, you know, just listen to those the guitar intros just sound even better now. Oh. And then, because Chuck Berry was not meant to be listened to on an iPod or on a CD, it was meant to be listened to, you know, well, as it was on vinyl in a jukebox, but cassette tape's the closest route I'm going to get without spending lots of money. Not that I couldn't afford it, you know, I'm living in the Temple of the Dean and all that, but it's not the point. If you get a cassette tape for like £4, you might as well go for that. And, yeah, it's pretty good. Okay, I just got back from town. It's the beginning of Christmas, evidently. where we have the Christmas tree, lights go on, and all the lights that have been put up throughout the town, well, in the main street anyway, they all get lit up, and it's all fun, and people are singing Christmas carols. Now, they did which one did they do? O Come All Ye Faithful, I like that one. The choir did that, male choir. And then lots of people came up, and children with lanterns, and a person in a robin, like the bird, a robin costume, on roller skates, that's pretty cool. And of course a gentleman in a top hat, and saying, oh, lovely, lovely, yes, on a penny farthing bicycle, great times. And you gotta love it. Oh, School Days just came on, and I'm liking the fast version here. Anyway, so maybe it's his live, I don't know, he's always faster live, but like ACDC. So, what was I saying? Yes, and people in all sorts of costumes, and Santa in a sleigh, driven by a train, and like all the lights everywhere, and it was all pretty, and people and people dressed in all sorts of costumes, and on stilts, and reindeers, and snowmen, and such like, and so on, and so forth, and things, and stuff, and etc. And of course, playing songs like that one, We Three Kings, which is my favourite, and that other one, Oh, Star of Wonder, Star of Night, Star of Royal Beauty Bright, Westward leading, still proceeding, guide us to thy perfect light. On the Christmas episode, I think I'll play, during the Dean Sings, that Christmas song I made. Xmas. Anyway, so that was the Christmas festivities, all the lights. The rest of the town had no lights at all, except the Civic Centre and the Mall. And there were a few lights in other streets, but they didn't appear to be on. But I must say, very good. I'm enjoying the lights and the carols and the things and the stuff and the people and the things and the stuff. And it was really, really awesome. And all the costumes and the festivities. Of course, unfortunately, they bibled at us. They started reading Bible verses and handing out leaflets, and I was much displeased. So it's now time for Booster of the Week. Oh, damn it, I don't know where I put the darn thing. There was a poster of the week. It was a leaflet they gave me. Well, I've lost the darn thing. But it was like about snow and stuff. And on it, is all this. Thaddeus, why don't you tell us, in fact? Exactly. It's all this stuff about snow, and it's like little poems and stuff, and it's really cool. And then like right at the end, just like also, Luke chapter 5 verse 32. You are all sinners. Ah, Christ, stop things. Matthew verses thing. Bible, sinners, repent, hell, Christ. And it's like, oh, well, that brought the atmosphere down. And then we had like a 20-minute preaching session during which the whole crowd ignored the guy and started talking. Which is amusing. That is all. Gaming. There is too much of it needed. I already didn't get Left 4 Dead 2 because of Niall switching to PC. Or Smart Anniversary Raw 2010 because I don't want it. Even though it actually looks pretty good this year, there's a bunch of new stuff in it. But I just bought this Modern Warfare 2. So now I've got something to play during the next month. I can still play it afterwards, of course, but at Christmas, I'm getting Dragon Age Origins 2 for myself, so gotta have that. And then, of course, that has like 100 hours of gameplay. And then in February, Bioshock 2 comes out, I think. And it has a multiplayer mode as well now, so craziness. Plus, I think Dante's Inferno comes out around then, and it's supposed to be really good. So these four games together could take me up to this time next year. In a totally separate note, I'm still listening to Chuck Berry. I don't know if it's picking up on this, but it's great, and I'm loving it. Quick note, I was turned on my television during Q, the music channel, were showing their 100 classic air guitar moments, and I turned on at number 17, now I recorded the rest, I haven't watched it yet. 17, right from the very start I got to see Iron Maiden's Run for the Hills video. Huzzah! Then I switched over to MTV2, and got to see from the very start Journey's Don't Stop Believin'. Huzzah! I'd never seen that one before. What good fortune. Such good fortune there. Apparently it was Journey's one was the second best-selling rock song of the week. Interesting. Then it cuts off before the end for some reason. But there you go, that's that.
Whoa, more journal than you can shake a stick at. Okay, so before we wrap it up, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to do the plugs, then we're going to have the Dean Sings, and then you'll have your outro and your close song, and then you'll have a 40-minute lecture from Reese on the Irish Home Rule question. If I were you, I'd skip it, because that's what I'm going to do when I listen back. But it's there, it's at the very end, so, you know, after the outro and the end song, just turn off. You don't need to listen to that end bit. But it is there, if you care, which you won't. Inferior scum! One thing that hasn't happened enough this show, I don't think, is I haven't pointed out that I am superior to you, that you are inferior scum, that I am awesome, and that I am the master of divinity, the eternal entity, the most powerful person who can exist, the awesome The Dean. So that's in there, and now the plugs, of course, thedeanshow.blogspot.com for all the stuff from us, including iTunes links, merch links, things, stuff, friends like the Sanjay Show, the Double HQ News Hour, Thoughts Out of Context, Wheelie's World, The Good Atheist, and all that good stuff. So, there's that. Also, Logicon is looking at putting us on the Pirate Base, that's good. Occasional doer of stuff. Yeah, so I think that's all, everything's been plugged, really. That's that, and we're going to have the Dean Sings.
This is the jingle to introduce the jingle. This is the jingle that introduces the segment that we like to call The Dean Sings. The Dean Sings uses songs from promotingcrap.com.
Okay, this week's subject is the playground, and I think this is a really good one. Possibly one of my favorites thus far, so nice music with it. Playing in the playground. People like to play in the playground. Always playing in the playground. I can play in the playground. Will you play in the playground? In the playground. We got the slides gonna go on. The slides gonna slide from the top to bottom. Gonna play tig in the playground. Running around and chasing him, and then you got him. Go on the swings. Go on the swings. You know you love those things. The swings, how high can you get? Swinging in the swings. You always love the playground, except when it's wet.
When it's wet.
Playground, playground. Roundabouts are awesome, cause they spin you round and round. Be careful not to run too fast, or you may fall on the ground.
Play
in the playground.
Play.
Playing on those things in the playground.
Play.
Using all the things in the playground.
Play.
Playing in the playground all the time.
Play.
In the crazy tire ride. In the playground, in the playground. You know I love playing in my playground. Okay. Okay, that's us for this week. Thaddeus, say goodbye, and then I'll tell you what we're going to take us out with. Okay, we're going to take you out with a live rendition of Majestic by the awesome Trapdoor. The Dean Show was created, conceived, performed, hosted, and produced by The Dean for The Dean. Tea by Thaddeus Penguin. Wrestling Show Musics by Evan Armstrong. Artwork by Evan Armstrong. Backstabbing and Betrayal by Logic Honor. Intro voiceover by Danny from The Senjay Show. Intro music and outro music by 10-Year Vamp, Kindred Souls, and Russian Band. Music used from Aerial Publicity, Cyber PR, and MeView Music Alley, PodSafe Music Network. The Dean Sings segment uses music from PromotingCrap.com. F My Life segment uses anecdotes from FMyLife.com.
That was the Dean Show. Coming up, they're coming to take me away.
What I want to do today, over the course of the three talks, is to really try and focus on exam work, on what you'll have to do come June when you sit this particular examination. So, in the first lecture, I'm going to look at the Home Rule Crisis. In the third one, I'm going to look at the rise of Sinn Féin. Those are the two most popular topics that have been asked in essay questions up to the present. That doesn't mean, don't ring me up afterwards if they don't come up with it. But they are the most popular topics, so we'll look at those two in the lectures. For the session in between, I want to focus on the new style document question. And I have a question made out and documents for everybody, and I'll talk you through that. So the first one then is on the Home Rule Crisis. I'm going to look at four questions here. Again, trying to focus on what an examiner might ask you. The first, why did Irish Unionists oppose Home Rule? Secondly, why did the Home Rule issue provoke such bitter division and conflict in Britain between the Liberals and Conservatives there? Thirdly, I want to look at Carson and try and assess how effective his leadership of the Unionist crusade against Home Rule was in the period up to 1914. And finally, we'll have a look at Redmond, the nationalist leader, and just try and work out how far he himself personally was to blame for the failure to deliver Home Rule. Those are four things I picked out because they're the most obvious questions that could be asked in this, I think. So this first question, why did Irish Unionists oppose Home Rule? Well, I think we can make two general points here at the outset. Firstly, Unionists were people who had prospered under the Union. They therefore wanted to maintain the status quo. They thought the Union was beneficial to Ireland. Many of them believed it. Carson believed it. He thought the Union was good for Ireland. And he didn't make any distinction there between the North and the South. Secondly, we're dealing here with people who were concerned about their future under a Home Rule Parliament. Interestingly, always under a Home Rule Parliament. If you ever read any of the correspondence from the time, Unionists always refer to their future position under a Home Rule Parliament, not in a Home Rule Parliament. So we're dealing here with people who are anxious about their future as a Protestant minority. Of course, there are two different types of Unionists, and you would be expected in an essay to deal with both. When you're talking about Southern Unionists and their opposition to Home Rule, essentially here you're talking about the defence of landlord rights, the defence of landlordism. This was best put, I think, this is a man who wasn't a landlord, W.E.H. Leggie. Leggie was a Unionist MP. He was a famous academic at Trinity. a Southern Unionist, but I think he articulated the Southern Unionist landlord fear most emphatically in the 1890s when he said at one point that Unionists could have stomached a Home Rule Parliament dominated by a Catholic gentry. That would have been okay. But what they couldn't have was a Home Rule Parliament dominated by their agrarian tormentors, supported by the votes of the peasantry, as he put it, and subsidised by what he called the avowed enemies of the British Empire in America. So what Leckie is really saying is that for Southern Unionists, Home Rule is also about class struggle. This is a social and economic and political elite, and they're worried about their future. They're also opposed to democracy, of course, which before 1918, you know, was a perfectly valid political position for some of these people to hold. And for them, of course, democracy meant Catholic rule. I mean, that had been clear since O'Connell's time. On another level, of course, all Unionists believed that Home Rule would lead to social and economic chaos, and they were worried about religious liberty, civil and religious liberty, as they put it. But obviously, it's among Ulster Unionists that fear was most acutely felt. Ulster Unionists, then, one question you would need to deal with is this: was there this idea of a regional identity? The two things I could say here: in 1892, at the Ulster Unionist Convention, as you may know, up above on the big wooden pavilion they built was this great big banner, Erin-go-Grat, Ireland Forever. So these people were Irishmen, certainly at one level. So how important is this regional identity? Homer Law expressed this when he said, look, if Irish people can have home rule, can have self-determination, then surely you can't deny that right to people in Ulster, because they're different. And he actually said, you know, there are two peoples in Ireland. So you need to say something about this separate identity, this regional identity. The other things, of course, in Ulster, there was a very strong economic case that they put against Home Rule. I think this is most clearly articulated by an MP, Thomas Sinclair, an ex-Liberal, but Sinclair was a very prominent Presbyterian, very prominent Presbyterian. He was also very prominent in articulating the economic argument against Home Rule. Sinclair pointed out that Ulster paid 4/5 of the 80% of the taxes in Ireland. 80% of the taxation was raised in Ulster. He also explained, and this is relevant to the credit crunch times we live in, he explained that under Home Rule, Ulster business, Ulster enterprise would struggle to obtain capital in the financial markets. So, you know, there would be an automatic loss of credit with a future downturn anticipated as a consequence, because there would be a collapse in confidence. The people who were supplying the money to business in the rest of the United Kingdom would put that money elsewhere. He also, by the way, he'd done a lot of work on stock prices, share prices, showing that when Home Rule really threatened, I mean, the price of particular stocks in Ulster really did go down sharply. So, I mean, for him, Home Rule would be economic catastrophe. Then there's another side to that argument. The historian Joe Lee, who's one of the best and most authoritative historians certainly to have written anything in the past 30 years, Lee has said, you know, this economic argument against Home Rule is a red herring, because in Ulster, you're talking here textiles, shipbuilding, engineering, these are old industries. Ulster really is about to fall into the edge. Ulster is an economic story in decline. So he said, you know, this idea of a powerful economic argument, it doesn't really hold. Now, that's okay for Lee writing as he wrote that in the 1980s. But obviously, he was coming at it from a particular angle, but I thought, and I would have thought, and I still think, if you had been in Belfast in 1912 or 13, it was a mightily impressive place. You know, the biggest shipyard in the world, the biggest textile factory, etc., etc. In Edwardian United Kingdom, Belfast was a mighty, I would have thought, a mightily impressive industrial area. But it's really not about the economy, as one of those questions maybe last year or the year before indicated. It's really religious fears that unionists highlight in their opposition to Home Rule. And there are particular things you might want to refer to when you're talking about these religious objections to Home Rule. The first is the Orange Order. The Orange Order witnessed a dramatic rise in membership in the period, the decade from 1903 to 1913. I mean, its membership in Belfast, for example, more than doubled to more than 19,000. In that period, people who were afraid of Home Rule naturally drifted towards the Orange Order. The mirror image of the Orange Order, and this was particularly important in Ulster, was the Ancient Order of Hibernians. And for many Ulster unionists, they saw the AOH as more important, much more important than the Irish Party with its southern leadership. When they thought about Home Rule and Irish nationalism, they thought about the AOH, and they didn't like what they saw. One of the things they feared, for example, was that Irish, the language, would be compulsory in any public appointment. So for any public job, you would need a qualification in Irish. That was the sort of propaganda that was doing the rounds at the time. The Nay Terror of 1908 Papal Decree said that unless mixed marriages were canonized by the Catholic Church, they would be declared invalid. Now, unionist propaganda made some hay with that, but that really took off in 1911 with this McCann case, as it was known. Alexander McCann was a Belfast Catholic. He left his wife, he separated from his wife, and he took his four children with him. But later it was alleged that he had been, this is just one case, but it really does highlight, I think, these Ulster unionist fears. Later it was alleged that he'd been encouraged to do this by local Catholic clergy. I mean, the Belfast newsletter was one organ of the press that really jumped on the propaganda bandwagon at the time, saying, you know, this is the sort of clerical interference we can accept. Expect that on a daily basis if we have a Home Rule Parliament. So the McCann case, you know, becomes, because it happened in Belfast and the peculiar circumstances surrounding it, it becomes a kind of cause célèbre for Ulster unionists who don't miss a trick when it comes to propaganda against Home Rule. The last thing there is something that sometimes overlooked. The influence of the Catholic clergy in politics in Ulster was more pronounced than it was in the rest of Ireland. And there's a good reason for that. In Ulster, I think, the Catholic bourgeoisie was not as prominent. In other words, among the Catholic laity, there wasn't the political leadership that you had in the rest of the country. So naturally, in those circumstances, clerics, priests, local priests at local level moved in to fill that vacuum. So it was true that in the period before 1914, the local Catholic clergy were very prominent in nationalist politics in the north. Again, unionist propaganda highlighted that all the time. What they didn't highlight, of course, was that Protestant clergy were almost equally prominent in unionist politics. So that was something, of course, they chose to overlook. So I think for those reasons, Irish unions suppose for a variety of reasons. Now that might be easily understood by people in Ireland, but it wasn't necessarily easy to understand for people in the United Kingdom. Sometimes this is asked in an exam, you know, why was there no agreement between liberals and conservatives? Why were they so divided on the Home Rule issue? Well, the first thing you would be expected to address here is the divisions between liberals and conservatives had their origins in English political matters. And there are three things here that I've highlighted. In politics, if you think at the minute that Cameron and Brown don't like each other, well, they don't like each other, and that today Labour and Conservatives are far apart, but it's nothing in comparison to what we had nearly 100 years ago with the Liberals and Conservatives. The 1909 People's Budget was Lloyd George's budget in November 1909, which the Tories assumed he had drawn up proposals to provoke this constitutional crisis, imposing this tax, this land tax, on the wealthy landlord class in England, which of course they rejected in the House of Lords. They rejected the money law. This provokes this constitutional crisis, which runs right through 1910 and into 1911. Two parties far apart, bitter exchanges all through 1910. A series of conferences organised to try and find agreement, consensus, all fail. So it's against this background that we have two general elections in 1910, both of which, of course, produce hung parliaments. So the crisis continues, it intensifies. Finally, we have the 1911 Parliament Act, which is particular importance for Ireland because, as you know, the 1893, the second Home Rule Bill, was rejected in the House of Lords. After the 1911 Parliament Act, the House of Lords would only be able to hold up legislation for up to 2 years. So that had important ramifications for the future success of Home Rule, but more importantly for English politics, it really highlighted the divisions between Liberals and Conservatives. Really bitter. The Conservatives were outraged, furious at the way the Liberal government had passed the 1911 Parliament Bill. Now, from there, you know, in those elections that we referred to, and trying to link this back to Ireland now, what I'm saying is tensions, divisions are incredibly deep in English politics at the time. Now you throw in Home Rule into the mix and things get worse. So begin here, we'll look at the Conservatives. First point here to note, I think, is that on the Home Rule issue, Tories believe that the normal rules of the political game, and to many of these people, politics wasn't paid. I mean, MPs are not paid. Look at the expenses now. They weren't even paid at all until 1911. So for many of them, it was a pastime. But the game, or how they regarded the game, the rules of the game have been suspended with the introduction of Home Rule because the Liberals haven't put that in their manifesto. So Tories were outraged at this, and they felt no obligation to play by the normal rules. This explains, I think, or begins to explain, the kind of extreme reaction to Home Rule that you get from Conservatives. There were, of course, those surviving ideological links from 1886, when Gladstone first proposed Home Rule. The Liberals and the Irish Nationalists, the IPP, were joined together, and in opposition, the Conservatives and Irish Unionists joined together to battle against Home Rule. So those still remained and became very important. But a third thing, a and it's more important than those other two, is the impact of Bonar Law's elevation to the leadership of the Conservative Party in November 1911. I think this is very important. One historian, Nicholas Mansard, is his name, who says that when you look at partition, the most important reason for partition, the single most important event in the history of partition, is Bonar Law becoming leader of the Conservative Party in November 1911. He was a man, of course, who had contact with Ulster Unionism. His brother was a doctor in Coleraine. He visited them every single weekend. He came across here. He was born in Ulster. His father was a Presbyterian minister and emigrated to Canada. He was sent back to be educated, stayed with an aunt and educated in Scotland, where he made his fortune. He was a very, very wealthy man. He was a millionaire in 1900. So here's another one, he's in a sense playing at politics, but conviction-wise, he's a man who empathised totally with Ulster Unionists and their objection to Home Rule. That's why he's so important. He's also, of course, leading a party that is split, deeply split. The Tory party in 1911 had torn itself apart. The Tory party did this three times in its history. Once before in the 1840s over the Corn Laws, once in the 1990s over Europe, but here in the early 1900s they were deeply split on this issue of tariff reform. Would they have free trade or would they have imperial preference? And both wings of the Conservative Party diverged in this. They were also deeply split, and the groups don't always emphasise this, but they were also deeply split over the tactics that they had pursued to try and protect the powers of the House of Lords. So those divisions, I mean, were very deep in the Conservative Party. The other thing about Bonar Law you need to know is he's a compromised choice. You know, he's the outsider in the race to become leader when Balfour resigned in November 1911. The two most prominent candidates, Walter Long and Austin Chamberlain, they dislike each other so much and their supporters dislike each other so much that they agree on a third choice, a compromise. So that's where Bonar Law comes from. The other thing I think that's important for this question about the bitterness between Liberals and Conservatives at the time is Bonar Law's political style. His leadership style. There's one word sums up Bonar Law, and that's confrontation. He wasn't interested in consensus. He wasn't interested, really, in finding common ground with his political opponents. He was very much a confrontational type politician. And the other thing, of course, he's leading a party that has just lost three general elections in a row. That's very important. This is a party reeling from electoral defeat. And at the time, many people actually thought that the Tories would never hold office again. So here is a new leader desperately needing to unite his party and turn the electoral tide. There's one issue he seizes on that will unite his party, and that's opposition support for the movement. The Liberals, on the other hand, what can we say about the Liberals? I think Asquith, the Liberal Prime Minister, he felt an obligation to do the best he could for the Irish, for Irish nationalists. But as far as the government was concerned, he relied too much on his chief secretary, Justin Birrell. He'd been chief secretary for Ireland since 1907. Birrell's problem was he had no understanding of the unionism at all. Asquith relied on him, so they didn't get the government. The one Liberal minister who really understood the Home Rule crisis and the Ulster Unionist position was Lloyd George. from the outset, Lord George knew when Home Rule came up, either the Ulster Unionists were going to have to be coerced, forced into accepting Home Rule, or they were going to have to be excluded from the Home Rule Bill. He saw that right away. Asquith didn't agree on it. That's very important. In fact, Asquith was complacent in his attitude to unionism. And that led him to make this strange speech in July 1912 in Dublin, actually, where he referred to the supposed opposition of Ulster. He thought it was all bluff, and he actually said this. And it was that speech, of course, that brought the retort from Bonner Law and Blenheim, when he said that there, thing is stronger than parliamentary majority. That's the context in which Bonner Law made that speech. So those are important things. Asquith's political style, it's quite famous because Roy Jenkins wrote this biography in 1964, and this is stuck. Asquith was all about wait and see. That was his catchphrase. He was never proactive. No, he waited for things to happen, and then he would intervene. Now, as far as the Third Home Rule Bill is concerned, this is what he thought. And I think this explains the tension, or partly explains the tension between the two parties. Asquith thought, right, we have introduced the Third Home Rule Bill. If the opposition, if the Tories don't like it, then it's up to them to move an amendment. It's not up to us. So he sat back and he waited. But I think Bonner Law in the circumstances would have been tempted to say, okay, let's exclude Ulster and we'll accept the rest. Bonner Law's problem was two problems. I think one, he was a little unsure of himself. Bonner Law was at the beginning elected without the confidence. Remember, he was only third choice. And the number two in his party, Lord Lansdowne, who some historians have said he was almost co-leader in this early phase. Lansdowne is a Southern Unionist. So I think he has to be very careful on and off at that stage of articulating his just the single Ulster Unionist dimension. That's why he chooses not to do that. Go ahead. Gets his feet under the table. Once he starts to grow a bit of confidence, and you can see this in 1913, one of the things when I read some of the speeches that he gave, especially during 1913, he constantly refers, almost in a matter of fact way, to the prospect of civil war. You know, we can expect civil war, impending civil war. So he cranks up, if you like, the tension all through 1913. Now, he does meet Asquith in private three times between October and December 1913, and there is some, you know, grounds for optimism, although it's clear from that point on that any compromise is going to be on the basis of a nationalist concession. Still, you know, things did not look rosy, and you're between intervening now, and he's talking about civil war in Ireland, and he's talking about needing a conference to try and avert civil war in Ireland. Now, when that conference, Asquith finally gives in and allows this conference to go ahead in July 1914, this really, if you're asked this question in the exam, you need to talk about the Buckingham Palace Conference, because it really, I think, puts the spotlight on the failure of the Liberals and Conservatives to reach a compromise on the Third Home Rule Bill. I mean, they're there to discuss area and time. They never get on the time because they can't agree on the area of Ulster to be excluded from the Home Rule Bill. So, you know, I'd finish off there by highlighting those three things. There's an element of Tory opportunism here. They sense the Liberals are weak on this issue, and they go for it. It's the same thing as Randolph Churchill was doing in 1886. The second thing is this extraordinary, and that's the thing I would emphasise here, personal commitment that Homer Daw had, his belief in Ulster's right to be excluded from the Home Rule Bill, and as I say, his empathy with Ulster, and the Asquith's procrastination, his wait-and-see strategy, what I call that, his dithering. You know, why he dithered, things got worse, divisions intensified. Third question we need to look at, I think, is this assessment of Carson and his leadership of the anti-Home Rule Crusade. You know, how effective was it? Well, first impression is very effective. But there's a point Alvin Jackson makes. You know, he's there at Stormont, the big statue. Every unionist leader since has pandered to that statue and has tried to cast himself as Carson's heir. But ultimately, Carson's failed him. Jackson makes that point because he fails to see Ireland from Hope Hill. It's also, and some historians have highlighted this, Roy Foster in particular. I mean, Carson goes over it's too extreme. It appears like that. I mean, Roy Foster has written that Unionist opposition under Carson was ludicrously extreme in that respect. But the thing about Carson's fear is that, you know, Home Rule, that's opening the door, and it's going to lead to complete separation. That was his fear. In 1911, he had boldly stated, if Ulster succeeds, Home Rule is dead. And I think he believed that. I think Carson believed in 1911 that Home Rule without Ulster would be impossible, and the measure would just collapse, it would be dropped. What was his style of leadership? This is interesting. He used militant rhetoric, for example, he spoke about provisional government. What a dangerous concept, a provisional government. Where do you think Pierce got the idea in 1916? And he engaged in these great public rallies and demonstrations. But he was very worried about violence privately. Very concerned about violence. The violence that erupted in the summer of 1950 condemned, and that led, I think, directly to the Covenant. This is what I would offer about Carson. I think he's a different type of leader. He's very like Parnell, that's how I see him. You know, he's different from his followers. I often wonder, the Ulster Unionist mentality, which is quite unique, I often wonder how much did Carson really understand that mentality. One thing he did understand, by the way, was English politics. Really understood that. And I think we can argue that his real success as a leader of this Unionist crusade against Home Rule was in restraining his more hot-headed followers in Ulster, reeling them in, if you like. That, and he had a big impact in England. I mean, Carson was looked upon in England at the time as a big player, and he knew if he was going to continue to be a big player in England, he couldn't allow this opposition at Home Rule to get out of hand in Ulster. It had to be under control. That gave him a powerful lever in England, I think. So that's important. He, however, changed his strategy in September 1930. This is Carson at his most pragmatic. It's clear that the government is not going to back down, that they're going to press ahead with Home Rule. So now Carson has to turn his back on his fellow Southern Unionists and save as much of Ulster as he can. This is crystallised in a letter he writes to Bonner Law on the 25th of September 1913. Now Bonner Law had been hedging, of course, all the time towards leaving Ulster out. He didn't really care about Southern Unionists. Carson, by September 1913, actually said, look, the way things are shaping up, I think we need to leave out. we can make a good case for leaving out six plantation counties. There were only four plantation counties, but Carson didn't know too much about Ulster's history, but he knew what he thought he could get away with, and he articulates this in 1913 in September. This is a change in strategy, where he finally now articulates this view. We can't defeat Home Rule for all of Ireland. Let's save as much of Ulster as we can. The final thing I'd say about Carson is he had this ability to influence Redmond. He could appeal to Redmond, as he did, for example, in that famous speech he made on the House of Commons, in the House of Commons, on the 9th of February 1914. That was the speech where he said to Redmond, look, don't try and oppress us, coerce us. Try and win us over by, you know, friendliness and argument. 3 weeks later, Redmond accepts Lloyd George's County Option Speech. So we had, I think, the ability to influence Redmond. Finally, Redmond. You might be asked about Redmond on his own, or Redmond by Carson. But how much can we blame Redmond himself for the failure to deliver on this? Redmond is a character. He's not like the rest, some fiery figures in the Home Rule Party. He was in some way very restrained, a quietly spoken, measured, conservative individual. He wasn't a militant. His great hero was Parnell. He wasn't like Parnell. Parnell always had the capacity to contemplate ruthless action, and he always conveyed a hint of menace. He was like, in that sense, Parnell was like Carson, not like Redmond. Redmond wasn't that type of character, yet he was a good political leader, and I've pointed out a few things, I think, that prove that. Firstly, he was quite decisive in 1910, when the opportunity presented itself. The hung parliament, he moved quickly there to make sure that Asquith went down the Home Rule route. He did that very well. Secondly, when the Agar Roberts amendment to leave out four counties was proposed in June 1912, now that threw Carson into something of a dilemma. It was also a problem for the Nationalists. At the time, Redmond moved quickly to persuade Asquith and other senior figures in the government not to adopt that as a government measure, to ignore it, and that's what they did. Thirdly, he was a speaker who could, you know, sometimes just with a very memorable turn of phrase really catch his audience, and he did that most famously on the 12th of October 1913. In a speech he made in Limerick, when he replied to an earlier speech, Churchill, that he had 3 days earlier in Dundee, and he said, when it came back to Compton, he said, you know, the two nations theory is to us an abomination and a blasphemy. He was rejecting, he said, Ireland is one nation, not two nations. So he could capture the public mood, and he did that very effectively at that point. However, he's affecting the events. Things just, you know, the formation of the Irish Volunteers, which I've talked about in the third lecture, I think really undermined Redmond in November 1913. And then the outbreak of the war, you know, Kitchener's refusal to form an Irish Brigade, the formation of a coalition government in May 1915, which contained Bonner Law and Carson in the government. Redmond offered a place, but declined. And finally, of course, the Easter Rising, which really did for constitutional nationalism and Redmond. The other thing I would say, though, is that previous to being a victim of the death, he had made mistakes. I think he was always reacting. He was always on the back foot. Carson was proactive. He was reacting to events. He was remarkably complacent about Ulster's threats of resistance. Not entirely his fault. He was being advised by the Belfast Nationalist leader, Joe Detlow, And he said, this is all bluff. But he was, I mean, Redmond was taking his advice, and it turned out to be, you know, flawed, I think. And he didn't see his own position becoming deeper towards the end of 1913. And Robert, he said this 40 years ago, he said, Redmond's problem was that he was too dependent on liberal goodwill. Once that goodwill was withdrawn, even though he felt he held the balance of power, his position was never as strong as he perceived it to be. I mean, he wasn't going to turn the Liberals out and the Conservatives, so he was dependent on the Liberal government, on Asquith's goodwill. The final thing, of course, is, let's just mention this first, county auction, March 1914, there he breaks the one Ireland principle. That was a mistake. Redmond is a conciliator. That wasn't the time to seek consensus. And finally, of course, Woodenbridge, that speech on the 20th of September 1914, when he commits the Irish Volunteers to Foreign Service, that turns out to be an absolute disaster as far as he's concerned. Final point I want to make about Redmond is a number of historians have heard of this, you know, things were going against him. He was reacting to it, but the war presented an opportunity and he failed to take it. At the beginning of the war, he should have demanded home rule there and then. One historian, however, has rejected that and said it would have been completely out of character. The wrong thing, that's Paul Dew. But other historians have challenged that. So I, you know, as far as you doing an essay in the exam, that's one thing I would highlight. The outbreak of the war, there was an opportunity for Redmond to really dig in his heels, demand home rule, exploit British weakness. Paul Dew said he would never have done that because that would have risked a German victory in the First World War. You know, he should have been looking first and foremost at Ireland and his people in Ireland there. I'll finish here just by saying, a former Taoiseach, John Bruton, has identified himself with Redmond. And, you know, this has been very controversial in Irish history in the last 10 or so years. Bruton's thesis is that, you know, if they listened to Redmond, Redmond would have got them all they got without the violence. Now, that's easy to say, you know, looking back from 2000, whatever, at the time, not easy to say, couldn't predict the future. I would say, you in an essay, you want to criticise Redmond, particularly the mistakes he makes from late autumn 1913 on. Those four things, I think, are, as far as that topic is concerned, that's what we need to ask for. Thank you. I think they're having a break for 15 minutes or so, and then I'll give out these